Welcome to this Uvula audio production of Aunts Are Not Gentlemen by P.G. Wodehouse, Volume 2, Chapter 5.
I headed for the cottage where I had left the car. By the time I got there, I should have done 3 miles of foot slogging, and I proposed to give the leg muscles a bit of time off. And if E. Jimson Murgatroyd didn't like it, let him eat cake. I was particularly anxious to get together with Jeeves and hear what he had to say about the strange experience through which I had just passed, as strange as an E as had ever come my way in what you might call a month of Sundays. I could make nothing of the attitude that Cook had taken up. Blagg's theory that his asperity had been due to the fact that Vanessa had gone to the wrong crowd in London seemed to me to be pure applesauce. I mean, if your daughter picks her social circle unwisely and starts clobbering the police, you don't necessarily accuse the first person you meet of stealing cats. The two things don't go together. Jeeves, I said, reaching the finish line and sinking into an armchair. Answer what I am about to ask you frankly. You've known me a good long time.
Yes, sir.
You've had every opportunity of studying my psychology.
Yes, sir.
Well, would you say I was a fellow who stole cats?
No, sir.
His ready response pleased me not a little. No hesitation, no humming and hawing, just no, sir. Exactly what I expect you to say. Just what anyone at the Drones or elsewhere would say. And yet, cat-stealing is what I've been accused of.
Indeed, sir.
By a scarlet-faced blighter named Cook. And forthwith, if that's the expression, I tell him about my strange E, passing lightly over my not having trusted his directions on reaching the high road. He listened attentively, and when I had finished, came as near to smiling as he ever does. That is to say, a muscle at the corner of his mouth twitched slightly, as if some flying object, such as a mosquito, had settled there momentarily.
I think I can explain, sir.
It seemed incredible. I felt like Dr. Watson hearing Sherlock Holmes talking about the 147 varieties of tobacco ash, and the time it takes parsley to settle in the butter dish. This is astounding, Jeeves! Professor Moriarty wouldn't have lasted a minute with you. You really mean the pieces of the jigsaw puzzle have come together and fallen into place?
Yes, sir.
You know all?
Yes, sir.
That is amazing!
Elementary, sir. I found the habitués of the goose and grasshopper a ready source of information.
Oh, you asked the boys in the back room?
Yes, sir.
And what'd they tell you?
It appears that bad blood exists between Mr. Cook and Colonel Briscoe.
They don't like each other, you mean?
Precisely, sir.
I suppose it's often that way in the country. Not much to do except think what a tick your neighbor is.
It may be as you say, sir, but in the present case there is more solid ground for hostility, at least on Mr. Cook's part. Colonel Briscoe is chairman of the Board of Magistrates, and in that capacity recently imposed a substantial fine on Mr. Cook for moving pigs without a permit.
I can see how this must have rankled. I do not keep pigs myself, but if I did, I should strongly resent not being allowed to give them a change of air and scenery without getting permission from a board of magistrates. Are we in Russia, after all?
Furthermore, sir.
Oh, that wasn't all.
No, sir. Furthermore, they are rival owners of racehorses, and that provides another source of friction.
Why?
Sir?
I don't see why. Most of the big owners are very chummy. They love one another like brothers.
The big owners, yes, sir. It is different with those whose activities are confined to small local meetings. There the rivalry is more personal and acute. In the forthcoming contest at Bridmouth-on-Sea, the race, in the opinion of my informants at the Goose and Grasshopper, will be a duel between Colonel Briscoe's Simla and Mr. Cook's Potato Chip. All the other entries are negligible. There is consequently no little friction between the two gentlemen as the date of the contest approaches, and it is of vital importance to both of them that nothing shall go wrong with the training of their respective horses. Rigid attention to training is essential, sir.
Well, he didn't need to tell me that. An old hand like myself knows how vital rigid training is for success on the turf. I had not forgotten the time at Aunt Dahlia's place in Worcestershire, where I had a heavy bet on Marlene Cooper, the gardener's niece, in the girls' under-15 egg and spoon race on Village Sports Day. On the eve of the meeting, she broke training, 8 pounds of unripe gooseberries, and got abdominal pains which prevented her from showing up at the starting post. But jeez, I said, while all this is of absorbing interest, what I want to know is why Cook got into such a frenzy about the cat. You ought to have seen his blood pressure. It shot up like a rocket. He couldn't have been more emotional if he had been a big shot in the Foreign Office, and I, a heavily veiled woman diffusing a strange exotic scent whom he had caught getting away with a naval treaty.
Fortunately, I am in a position to elucidate the mystery, sir. One of the habitués with whom I fraternized at the Goose and Grasshopper chances to be an employee of Mr. Cook, and he furnished me with the facts of the case. The cat was a stray which appeared one morning in the stable yard, and Potato Chip took an instant fancy to it. This, I understand, is not unusual with highly bred horses, though more often it is a goat or a sheep which engages their affection.
Well, this was new stuff to me. First I'd ever heard of it. A goat, I said.
Yes, sir.
Or a sheep?
Yes, sir.
You mean love at first sight?
One might describe it as such, sir.
What asses horses are, Jeeves?
Certainly their mentality is open to criticism, sir.
Though I suppose if for weeks you've seen nothing but cook and stable boys, a cat comes a nice change. I take it that the friendship ripened.
Yes, sir. The cat now sleeps nightly in the horse's stall and is there to meet him when he returns from his daily exercise.
A welcome guest, then?
Extremely welcome, sir.
They've put down the red carpet for it, you might say. Strange. I'd have thought a human vampire bat like Cook would have had a stray cat off the premises with a single kick.
Something of that nature did occur, my informant tells me, and the results were disastrous. Potato Chip became listless and refused his food. Then one day the cat returned, and the horse immediately recovered both vivacity and appetite.
Golly!
Yes, sir, the story surprised me when I heard it as well.
I rose. Time was getting on, and I had a vision of the Briscoes, with their noses pressed to the drawing-room window, looking out and telling each other that surely their Worcester ought to have shown up by now. Well, Jeeves, many thanks. With your customary, what do you call it, you have cast light on what might have remained a permanent brain-teaser. But for you I should have passed sleepless nights wondering what on earth Cook thought he was playing at. I now feel kindlier toward him. I still wouldn't care to have a go on a long walking tour with the son of a what-not, and if he ever gets himself put up for the drones, I shall certainly blackball him. But I can see his point of view. He finds me clutching his cat, learns that I am on pally terms with his deadly rival the Colonel, and naturally assumes that there is dirty work afoot. No wonder he yelled like a soul in torment and brandished his hunting crop. He deserves considerable credit for not having given me six of the best with it.
Your broad-minded view is to be applauded, sir.
Well, one must always strive to put oneself in the other fellow's place, and remember... Remember what?
To comprendre, c'est tout pardon.
Thank you, Jeeves.
Not at all, sir.
And now, ho for Eggersford Hall. If you ask about me in circles which I frequent, you'll be told I'm a good mixer, who's always glad to shake hands with new faces. And it ought to have been in a merry mood that I braked the car at the front door of Eggersford Hall. But it wasn't. Not that there wasn't anything about the new faces on the other side to give me the pip. Colonel Briscoe proved to be a genial host. Mrs. B, a genial hostess. There were also present, besides Aunt Dahlia, the Reverend Ambrose Briscoe, the Colonel's brother, and the latter's daughter, Angelica, a very personable wench, with whom, had I not been so preoccupied, I should probably have fallen in love. In short, as pleasant a bunch as you could wish to meet. But that was the trouble. I was preoccupied. It wasn't so much finding myself practically next door to Vanessa Cook that worried me. It would be pretty difficult for me to go anywhere in England where there wasn't somebody who had turned me down at one time or another. I've run across them in spots as widely separated as Bude, Cornwall, and Sedbergh, Yorks. No, what was occupying the Worcester mind was the thought of Pop Cook and his hunting crop. It was not agreeable to feel that one is on bad terms with a man who might run amuck at any moment, and who, if he did, would probably make a beeline for Bertram. The result was I did not shine at the festive bee. The lunch was excellent, and the port with which it concluded definitely super, and I tucked in with a zest which would have made Ejims and Murgatroyd drawn a sharp breath. But as far as sprightly conversation went, I was at a total loss. And the suspicion must have crossed the minds of my host and hostess fairly soon in the proceedings that they were entertaining a Trappist monk with a good appetite. That this had not failed to cross the mind of Aunt Dahlia was made abundantly clear to me when the meal was over, and she took me for a tour of what Jeeves had called the extensive grounds. She ticked me off with her habitual non-mincing of words. All through my life she had been my best friend and severest critic, and when she rebukes a nephew, she rebukes him good. She spoke as follows, her manner and diction similar to those of a sergeant major addressing recruits. "What's the matter with you, you poor reptile? I told Jimmy and Elsa that my nephew might look like a half-witted halibut, but wait till he starts talking, I said. He'll have you in stitches. And what occurs? Quips? Sallies? Diverting anecdotes? No, sir. You sit there stupefying yourself with food, and scarcely a sound out of you except the steady chomping of your jaws. I felt like an impresario performing fleas who has gotten for star artist a big build-up, only to have him forget his lines in the performing night." I bowed my head in shame, knowing how justified was the rebuke. My contribution to what I have heard called the feast of reason and flow of the soul had been, as I have indicated, about what you might have expected from a strong, silent Englishman with tonsillitis. "And the way you waded into that port, like a camel arriving at an oasis after a long journey through the desert sands! It was as if you had received private word from Jimmy that he wanted his cellar emptied quickly, so he could turn it into a game room. If that's the way you carry on in London, no wonder you came out all over in spots. I'm surprised you can walk." She was right. I had to admit it. "Did you ever see a play called 10 Nights in a Barroom?" I could bear no more. Weakly, I tried to plead my case. "I'm sorry, aged relative. What you say is true, but I'm not myself today."
"Well, that's a bit of luck for everyone."
"I'm what you could call distraught."
"You're what I would call a mess."
"I passed through a strange experience this morning. And with no further ado, or is it to-do? I never can remember. I told her my cat cook story. I told it well, and there was no mistaking her interest when I came to the part where Jeeves elucidated the mystery of the cat's importance in the scheme of things.
"Do you mean to say," she yipped, "that if you had gotten away with that cat—"
I had to pull her up here with a touch of asperity, in spite of the clearness with which I had been at pains to tell the story just right. She seemed to have gotten the wrong angle on the thing. "There's no question, old ancestor, of my getting away with the cat. I was merely doing the civil thing by tickling its stomach. But what you're suggesting is catnapping. That's as bad as nobbling a horse."
"But do you really mean that if someone were to get away with it, it would be all up with Potato Chip's training?"
"So Jeeves informs me, and he had it from a reliable source of the Goose and Grasshopper."
"Hmm.
What do you mean, whom?"
"Ha!"
"What do you mean, ha?"
"Never you mind."
"But I did mind. When an aunt says whom and ha, it means something, and I was filled with a nameless fear. However, I had no time to go into it, for at this moment we were joined by the Reverend Briscoe and his daughter, and shortly afterwards I left."
Chapter 6.
The afternoon had now hotted up quite a marked extent, and what with a substantial lunch and several beakers of port, I was more or less in the condition a python gets into after its midday meal. A certain drowsiness had stolen over me, so much so that twice in the course of my narrative the aged R had felt compelled to notify me that if I didn't stop yawning in her face, she would let me have one on the side of the fat head with the parasol with which she was shielding herself from the rays of the sun. There had been no diminution of drowsiness since last heard of, and as I bowled along the high road, I was practically in dreamland, and it occurred to me that if I didn't pause somewhere and sleep it off, I should shortly become a menace to pedestrians and traffic. The last thing I wanted was to come before my late host in his magisterial capacity, charged with having struck some citizen amidships while under the influence of his port. Colonel Briscoe's port, I mean, not the citizen's. Embarrassing for both of us, though in a way a compliment to the excellence of his cellar. The high road, like most high roads, was flanked on either side by fields, some with cows, some without. So the day being as warm as it was, just dropping anchor over here or over there meant getting as cooked to a crisp as Major Plank would have been, had the widows and the surviving relatives of the late chief of the Mugumbies established connection with him. What I wanted was shade, and by great good fortune, I came on a little turning, leading to a wooded country. Just what I needed. I drove into this wooded country, stopped the machinery, and it wasn't long before sleep poured over me in a healing wave, as the expression is. I started off by being one of those dreamless sleeps, but after a while a nightmare took over. It seemed to me that I was out fishing with E. Jimson Murgatroyd in what appeared to be tropical waters, and he caught a shark, and I was having a look at it when it suddenly got hold of my arm. This, of course, gave me a start, and I woke up. As I opened my eyes, I saw that there was something attached to my portside biceps, but it wasn't a shark. It was Orlo Porter.
"I beg your pardon, sir,"
he was saying,
"for interrupting your doze, but I'm a bird watcher. I was watching a Clarkson's warbler in that thicket over there, and I was afraid your snoring might frighten it away. So might I beg you to go easy on the sound effects? Clarkson's warblers are very sensitive to loud noises, and you were making yourself audible a mile away."
At least words to that general import. I would have replied, "Oh, hello," or something like that, but I was too astonished to speak, partly because I had never suspected that Orlo Porter could be so polite, but principally because he was there at all. I'd looked on Maiden Eggersford as somewhere where I could be free from all human society, a haven where I would have peace, perfect peace, with loved ones far away, as the hymn book says. And it was turning out to be a sort of meeting place of all nations. First Plank, then Vanessa Cook, and now Orlo Porter. If this sort of thing was going on, I told myself, I wouldn't be surprised to next see my Aunt Agatha coming around the corner arm in arm with E. Jimson Murgatroyd. Orlo Porter seemed now to recognize me, for he started like a native of India who sees a scorpion in his path, and went on to say,
"Worcester, you blasted, slimy, creeping, crawling serpent. I might have expected this."
It was plain that he was not glad to see me, for there was nothing affectionate in what he said or the way he said it. But apart from that, I was unable to follow him. He had me at a loss. "Expected what?" I asked, hoping for footnotes.
"That you would have followed Vanessa here, your object to steal her from me."
This struck me as so absurd that I laughed a light laugh, and he asked me to stop cackling like a hen whose union had been blessed, or laying a blasted egg, as he preferred to put it. "I haven't followed anyone anywhere," I said, trying to pour oil over the troubled W's. I debated with myself whether to add old man, and decided not to. I doubt if it would have had much effect anyway.
"Then why are you here?"
he demanded in a voice so fortissimo that it was obvious that he didn't give a damn if Clarkson's warblers heard him or legged it in a panic. I continued, suave. "The matter is susceptible of a ready explanation," I said. "You remember those spots of mine?"
"Don't change the subject."
"I wasn't. Having inspected the spots, the doctor advised me to retire to the country."
"There are plenty of other places in the country to retire to."
"Ah, yes, but my Aunt Dahlia is staying with some people here, and I knew it would make all the difference if I had her to exchange ideas with. Very entertaining woman, my Aunt Dahlia. Never a dull moment when she's around." This, as I had foreseen, had him stymied. Something of his belligerence left him, and I could see that he was saying to himself, "Could it be that I've wronged Bertram?" Then he clattered over again.
"All this is very plausible, but it does not explain why you were slinking round Eggersford Court this morning."
I was amazed. When I was a child, my nurse told me that there was one who was always beside me, spying out all my ways, and if I refused to eat my spinach, I would hear about it on Judgment Day. But it never occurred to me that she was referring to Orlo Porter. "How on earth did you know that?" I said, or perhaps gasped would be a better word, or even gurgled.
"I was watching the place through my bird-watching binoculars, hoping to get a glimpse of the woman I love."
This gave me the opportunity to steer the conversation to less controversial topics. I'd forgotten you were a bird watcher till you reminded me just now. You went in for it at Oxford, I remember. It wasn't a thing I would care to do myself. Not, I haste to add, that I've anything against bird watching. Must be most interesting. Besides, keeping you, I was about to say, out of the public houses, but I thought it was better to change it to out in the open air. And I said, what's the procedure? I suppose you lurk in a bush till a bird comes along, and then you out with the glasses and watch it. I had more to say, notably a question as to who Clarkson was and how he came to have a warbler, but he interrupted me.
I will tell you why you were sneaking around Eggersford Court this morning. It was in the hope of seeing Vanessa.
I know, but he paid no attention.
And I would like to say, for your guidance, Worcester, that if I catch you trying to inflict your beastly society on her again, I shall have no hesitation in tearing your insides out.
He started to walk away, paused, and then added over his shoulders the words, with my bare hands, and then he was gone. Whether or not to resume watching Clarkson's warblers, I have no means of knowing. My own feeling was that any level-headed bird with sensitive ears would have removed itself almost immediately after he had begun to speak.
Chapter 7.
These parting remarks of O. Porter gave me, as may readily be imagined, considerable food for thought. There happened at the moment to be no passers-by, but if any passers had been by, they would have noticed that my brow was knit and eyes a bit glazed. This always happens when you're turning things over in your mind and not liking the looks of them. You see the same thing in cabinet ministers when they're asked awkward questions in Parliament. It was not, of course, the first time an acquaintance had expressed a desire to delve into my interior and remove its contents. Roderick Spode, now going about under the alias of Lord Sidcup, had done so frequently when in the grip of the illusion that I was trying to steal Madeline Bassett from him, little knowing that she gave me a pain in the gizzard and that I would have willingly run a mile in tight shoes to avoid her. But I had never before had such a sense of imminent peril as now. Spode might talk airily, or is it glibly, of buttering me over the lawn and jumping on the remains with hobnail boots, but it was always possible to buoy oneself up with the thought that his bark was worse than his bee. I mean to say that a fellow like Spode has a position to keep up. He can't afford to indulge every passing whim. If he goes buttering people over lawns, he's in for trouble. Deborah's peerage tut-tuts, Burke's landed gentry raises its eyebrows, and as likely as not he gets cut by the county and has to emigrate. But Orlo Porter was under no such restraint. Being a communist, he was probably on palsy-walsy terms with half the big shots of the Kremlin, and the more of the bourgeoisie he disemboweled, the better they would be pleased. A young man with the right stuff in him, this Comrade Porter. He's got nice ideas, they would say when reading about the late Worcester. We must keep an eye on him with a view to further advancement. Obviously, then, the above Porter, having expressed himself as he had done about Vanessa Cook, the shrewd thing for me to do was to keep away from her. I put this up to Jeeves when I returned, and he saw eye to eye with me. What are those things circumstances have, Jeeves? I asked.
Sir?
You know what I mean. You talk of a something of circumstances which leads to something, and cats enter into it, if I'm not wrong.
Would concatenation be the word you are seeking, sir?
That's right! It was on the tip of my tongue. Do concatenations of circumstances arise?
Yes, sir.
Well, one has arisen now. The facts are these. When we were in London, I formed a slight acquaintance with a Miss Cook, who turns out to be the daughter of the chap who owns the horse, which thinks so highly of that cat. She had a spot of trouble with the police, and her father summoned her home to see that she didn't get into more. So she is now at Eggersford Court. Got the scenario so far?
Yes, sir.
This caused her betrothed, a man named Porter, to follow her here in order to give her aid and comfort. Got that?
Yes, sir. This frequently happens when two young hearts are sundered, sir.
Well, I met him this morning, and my presence in Maiden Eggersford came as a surprise to him.
One can readily imagine it, sir.
He took it for granted that I had come in pursuit of Miss Cook.
Like a young Lochinvar, sir, when he came out of the West.
The name was new to me, but I didn't ask for further details.
I saw that he was following the plot and never does when you're telling a story to wander off into side issues. And he said if I didn't desist, he would tear my insides out with his bare hands.
Indeed, sir.
You don't know Order Porter, do you?
No, sir.
Well, you know Spode. Porter is Spode plus. Hasty temper, quick to take offense. And the muscles of his brawny arms are strong as iron bands, as the fellow said. The last chap you'd want to annoy. So what do you suggest?
I think it would be advisable to avoid the society of Miss Cook, sir.
Exactly the idea that occurred to me. And it ought not be difficult. The chances of Pop Cook asking me to drop in are very slim. So I take the high road and she takes the low road. Answer that, will you, Jeeves? I said, as the telephone rang in the hall. It's probably Aunt Dahlia, but it may be Porter, and I do not wish to have speech with him. He went out to return a few moments later.
That was Miss Cook, sir, speaking from the post office. She desired me to inform you that she would be calling on you immediately.
The sharp Lord Lover Duck escaped from me, and I eyed him with reproach. He didn't think to say I was out.
Sir, the lady gave me no opportunity of doing so. She delivered her message and rang off without waiting for me to speak.
My brow got all knit again. This isn't good, Jeeves.
No, sir.
Calling at my home address like this?
Yes, sir.
Who's to say that Orlop Porter is not lurking outside with his bird-watching binoculars, I said. But before I could go into the matter in depth, the doorbell had rung, and Vanessa Cook was in my midst. Jeeves, I need scarcely say, had vanished like a family spectre at the crack of dawn. He always does when company arrives. I hadn't seen him go, and I doubted if Vanessa had. But he had gone. As I stood gazing at Vanessa, I was conscious of the uneasiness you feel when you run up against something particularly hot and are wondering when it's going to explode. It was more than a year since I had seen her, except in the distance, when about to be scooped up in by the police. And the change in her appearance was calculated to curdle the blood a bit. Her outer aspect was still that of a girl who would have drawn whistles from susceptible members of America's armed forces. But there was something sort of formidable about her which had not been there before. Something kind of imperious and defiant, if you know what I mean. Due, no doubt, to the life she had been leading. You can't go heading protest marches and socking the constabulary without it showing. Hard. That's the word I was trying for. She'd always been what they call a proud beauty, but now she was a hard one. Her lips were tightly glued together, her chin protruding, her whole layout that of a girl who intended to stand no Razzie Magoo. She reminded me of my childhood dancing mistress, except that the latter was way down in Class D as a looker, while she, as I have indicated, was the pin-up girl to end all pin-up girls. The thought occurred to me that in another 30 years or so she would look just like my Aunt Agatha, before whose glare, as it is well known, strong men curl up like rabbits. Nor was there anything in her greeting to put me at my ease, having given me a nasty look as if I ranked in her esteem in one of the lowest brackets. She said,
"I'm very angry with you, Bertie."
I didn't like the sound of that at all. It's never agreeable to incur displeasure of a girl with a punch like hers. I said I was sorry to hear that, and asked what seemed to be the trouble.
"Following me here."
There's nothing that braces one up like being accused of something to which you can find a ready answer. I laughed merrily, and her reaction to my mirth was much the same as Orlo Porter's had been. Though where he had spoken of hens laying eggs, she preferred the simile of a hyena with a bone stuck in his throat. I said I hadn't had a notion that she was in these parts, and this time she laughed. One of those metallic ones that are no good to man or beast.
"Oh, come on,"
she said. She added,
"Although I am furious, I can't help admiring you in a way. I'm surprised to find that you have so much initiative, Bertie. It is abominable, but it does show spirit. It makes me feel that if I had married you, I could have made something of you."
I shuddered from hair to shoe sole. I was even more thankful than before that she had given me the bum's rush. I knew what making something of me meant. 10 minutes after the bishop and colleague had done their stuff, she would have been starting to mould me and jack up my soul. And I like my soul the way it is. It may not be the sort of soul that gets crowds cheering in the streets, but it suits me, and I don't want people fooling about with it.
But it's quite impossible, Bertie. I love Orlo and can love no one else.
That's all right. Entirely up to you. I must put you straight on one thing, though. I really didn't know you were here.
Are you trying to make me believe that it was pure coincidence?
No, not that. More what I would call a concatenation of circumstances. My doctor ordered me a quiet life in the country, and I chose Maiden Eggersford because my aunt is staying with some people here, and I thought it would be nice to be near her. The quiet life in the country can be a bit too quiet if you don't know anyone. She got me this cottage. You might have thought that that would have cleaned up everything and made life one grand sweet song, as the fellow said, but no, she went on looking puff-faced. There's no pleasing some girls.
So, I was wrong in thinking you had initiative,
she said. And if her lip didn't curl scornfully, I don't know a scornfully curled lip when I see one.
You are just an ordinary footling member of the bourgeoisie that Orla dislikes so much.
Yes, a typical young man about town, some authorities say.
And I don't suppose you have ever done anything worthwhile in your life.
I could have made her look pretty silly at this juncture by revealing that I had won a scripture knowledge prize at my private school, a handsomely bound copy of a devotional work whose name has escaped me, and that when Aunt Dahlia was running that Milady's Boudoir paper of hers, I contributed to it an article, or a piece, as we writers call it, on what the well-dressed man is wearing. But I let it go, principally because she had gone on speaking. And it is practically impossible to cut in on a woman who has gone on speaking. They get the stuff out so damn quick that the slower male hasn't a hope.
But the matter of your wasted life is beside the point, Bertie. God made you, and presumably he knew what he was doing. So we need not get into that. What you will want to hear is my reason for coming to see you.
Any time you're passing, I said, in my polished way. But she took no notice and continued.
Father's friend, Major Plank, who was staying with us, was talking at lunch about someone named Worcester, who had called this morning, and when Father turned purple and choked on his lamb cutlet, I knew it had to be you. You are the sort of young man he dislikes the most.
Do young men dislike him?
Invariably. Father is and always has been a cross between Attila the Hun and a snapping turtle. Well, having found that you were in Maiden Eggersford, I came to ask you to do something for me.
Anything I can.
It's quite simple. I shall, of course, be writing to Orlo, but I don't want him to send his letters to the court, because Father, in addition to resembling a snapping turtle, is a man of low cunning who wouldn't hesitate to intercept and destroy them. And he always gets down to breakfast before I do, which gives him a strategical advantage. By the time I got to the table, the cream of my correspondence would be in his trouser pocket. So I am going to tell Orlo to address his letters care of you, and I will call for them every afternoon.
I never heard a proposition I liked the sound of less. The idea of her calling at the cottage daily, with Orlo Porter already heated to the boiling point, watching its every move, froze my young blood, and made my two eyes, like stars, start from their spheres, as I heard Jeeves put it. It was with infinite relief that I realized a moment later that my fears were groundless, there being no need for correspondence between the parties of the first and the second part. "But he's here," I said.
"Here? In Maiden Eggersford?"
"Right plum spang in Maiden Eggersford."
"Are you trying to be funny, Bertie?"
"Of course I'm not being funny. If I were being funny, I'd have had you in convulsions from the outset. I tell you, he's here. I met him this afternoon. He was watching a Clarkson's warbler, arising from which you don't happen to have any data relating to Clarkson, do you? I've been wondering who he was and how he got a warbler." She ignored my observation. "This generally happens with me. Show me a woman, I sometimes say, and I will show you someone who's going to ignore my observations." Looking at her closely, I noted a change in her aspect. I've said that her face had hardened as a result of going about the place sucking policemen. But now it had got all soft, and while her two eyes didn't actually start from their spheres, they widened to about the size of regulation golf balls, and a tender smile lit up her map, and she said,
"Well, strike me pink."
"But what's that effect?"
"So he's come. He's followed me."
She spoke as if it had given her no end of a kick that he had done this. Apparently, it wasn't being followed that she objected to.
It just had to be the right chap.
Like some knight in shining armor, riding up on his white horse.
Here would have been a chance to give Jeeves's friend who came out of the West a plug by saying that Orlo reminded me of him, but I had to give it a miss because I couldn't remember the fellow's name. I wonder how he managed to get away from his job, I said.
Oh, he was on his annual 2 weeks holiday. That's how he came to be at that protest march. He and I were heading the procession.
I know, I was watching from afar.
I have not found out yet what happened to him that day. After he knocked the policeman down, he suddenly disappeared.
Always the best thing to do if you knock a policeman down. He jumped into my car and I drove him to safety.
Oh, I see.
I must say, I thought she might have put it a bit stronger. One does not desire thanks for these little kindnesses. One does here and there, but considering that on his behalf I had interfered with the police in the execution of their duty, that's how the script reads, thereby rendering myself liable to a sizable sojourn on the chokey. A little enthusiasm would have not been amiss. Nothing to be done about it except give her a reproachful look. I did this. It made no impression whatever, and she proceeded.
Is he staying at the Goose and Grasshopper?
I couldn't say, I said. And if I spoke with a touch of, what do you call it in my voice, who can blame me? When I met him, we talked mostly about interior organs.
What's wrong with your interior organs, Birdie?
Nothing so far, but he thought there might be something later on.
Oh, yes. He has a wonderfully sympathetic nature, Birdie.
Yes, hasn't he?
Did he recommend anything that would be good for you?
As a matter of fact, he did.
Oh, how I like him.
She was silent for a while, no doubt pondering on all of Orlo's lovable qualities, many of which I had missed. At length she spoke.
He must be at the Goose and Grasshopper. It's the only decent inn in the place. Go there and tell him to meet me here at 3 o'clock tomorrow afternoon.
Here?
Yes.
You mean at this cottage?
Why not, Bertie?
I thought you might want to see him alone.
Oh, that's all right. You can go for a walk.
Once more I sent up a silent note of thanks to my guardian angel for having fixed it that this proud beauty should not become Mrs. Bertram Wooster. Her cool assumption that she had only got to state her wishes and all and sundry would jump to fulfil them gave me the pip. So stung was the Wooster pride by the thought of being slung out at her bidding from my personal cottage that it is not too much to say that my blood boiled, and I would probably have said something biting like, "Oh, yes?" Only I felt that a chevalier attitude, which I always aimed to have, ought not to crush the gentlest sex beneath the iron heel, no matter what the provocation. So I changed it to right ho and went off to the Goose and Grasshopper to give Order the lowdown.
Chapter 8.
I found Orlo in the private bar having a gin and ginger ale. His face, never much to write home about, was rendered even less of a feast for the eye by a dark scowl. His spirits were plainly at their lowest ebb, as so often happens when Sundered Heart A is feeling that the odds against his clicking with Sundered Heart B cannot be quoted at better than 100-8. Of course, he may have been brooding because he had just heard that a pal of his in Moscow had been liquidated that morning, or he had murdered a capitalist and couldn't think of a way of getting rid of the body. But I preferred to attribute his malaise to frustrated love, and I couldn't help feeling a pang of pity for him. He looked at me as I entered in a manner which made me realize how little chance there was of our ever exchanging presents at Christmas, and I remembered thinking what a lot of him there was, and all of it anti-Wooster. I'd often felt the same about Spode. It seemed that there was something about me that aroused the baser passions in men who were 8 feet tall and 6 across. I took this up with Jeeves once, and he agreed that it was singular. His eye, as I approached, was what I have heard described as lacklustre. Whatever it was that was causing this V-shaped depression, seeing me had not brought the sunshine into his life. His demeanor was that of any member of a Wednesday matinee audience, little to say a dead fish on a fishmonger's slab. Nor did he brighten when I had delivered my message. After I had done so, there was a long silence, broken only by the gurgling of ginger ale as it slid down his throat. Eventually he spoke, his voice rather like that of a living corpse in one of those horror films where the fellow takes the lid off the tomb in the vault beneath the ruined chapel, and blowed if the occupant doesn't start a conversation with him.
"I don't understand this."
"What don't you understand?
I said, adding comrade, for there's never anything lost by being civil. Any assistance I can give you in the way of solving any little problems you may have freely given. I'm only here to help. The amount of sunny charm I had put into these words ought to have melted the reserve of a brass monkey, but they got absolutely nowhere with him. He continued to eye me in an Aunt Agathesque manner.
It seems odd, if you say you are the merest acquaintance, that she should be paying you clandestine visits at your cottage. Take it in conjunction with your surreptitious appearance at Eggersford Court. It cannot but invite suspicion.
When somebody talks like that, using words like clandestine and surreptitious, and saying that something cannot but invite suspicion, the prudent man watches his step. It was a great relief to me that I had a watertight explanation. I gave it with a winning frankness which I felt could scarcely fail to bring home the bacon. My appearance at Eggersford Court wasn't surreptitious. I was there because I had come to the wrong house, and Miss Cook's visit to my cottage had to be clandestine because her father watches her as closely as the paper on the wall, and as she visited my cottage because there was no other way of getting in touch with you. She didn't know you were in Eggersford. She thought if she wrote you a letter that her pop would intercept it, he being a man who would intercept a daughter's letter at the drop of a hat. Well, that sounded absolutely copper-bottom to me, but he went on giving me the eye.
All the same, I find it curious she should have confided in you. It suggests intimacy.
No, I wouldn't call it that. Girls I hardly know confide in me. They look upon me as a father figure.
Father figure, my foot. Any girl who takes you for a father figure ought to have her head examined.
Well, let us say a brother figure, then. They know their secrets are safe with good old Bertie.
I'm not so sure you are good old Bertie. More like a snake who goes about the place robbing men of the women they love, if you ask me.
Certainly not, I protested, learning for the first time that this was what snakes did.
Well, it looks fishy to me,
he said. Then to my relief, he changed the subject.
Do you know a man named Spofforth?
No, I said, I didn't think so.
P.B. Spofforth. Big fellow, clipped mustache.
No, never met the fellow.
And you won't for some time. He's in the hospital.
Too bad. What sent him there?
I did. He kissed the woman I love at the annual picnic of the Slade Social and Outing Club. Have you ever kissed the woman I love, Worcester?
Good Lord, no!
Well, be careful not to. Did she make a long stay at your cottage?
No, very short, in and out like a flash. Just had time to say you were like a knight in shining armor, riding up on a white horse, and to tell me to show you up at my address tomorrow at 3 on the dot, and then she was off. This seemed to soothe him. He went on brooding, but now not so much like Jack the Ripper getting up steam for his next murder. He was not, however, quite satisfied.
I don't call it much of an idea, meeting at your cottage.
Why not?
We shall have you underfoot all the time.
Well, that's all right, comrade. I shall be going for a walk.
Ah,
he said, brightening visibly.
Going for a walk. Just the thing to do. Capital thing, exercise. Bring the roses back to your cheeks. Take your time. Don't hurry back. They tell me there are beauty spots around here well worth seeing.
And on this cordial note we parted, he to go to the bar for another gin and ginger, and I to go back and tell Vanessa that the pourparlers had been completed, and that he would be at the starting post at 3 p.m. in the morrow.
How did he look?
She asked, all eagerness. It was a little difficult to answer this, because he had looked like a small-time gangster with a painful gumboil. But I threw together a tactful word or two, which, as Jeeves would say, gave satisfaction, and she buzzed off. Jeeves came shimmering in shortly after she had left. He seemed a shade perturbed.
We were interrupted in our recent conversations, sir.
We were, Jeeves. I'm glad to say that I no longer need your advice. During your absence, the situation has become clarified. A meeting has been arranged and will shortly take place. In fact, here at this cottage at 3 o'clock tomorrow afternoon. I, not wishing to intrude, shall be going for a walk.
Extremely gratifying, sir,
he said, and I agreed with him.